This is part 20 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948. My work on glaucoma and the incidental work on the prevention and control of nearsightedness gained international recognition when I was invited to read papers on the subjects before the International Congress of Ophthalmology at Cairo, Egypt, in December 1937. An effort was made to suppress this presentation by the same group that has suppressed its complete publication in the U.S. to this date. They were compelled to content themselves with inducing the officials of the Giza Memorial Ophthalmic Hospital to repeat the absurd errors of Professor Alan C. Woods and to publish an identically false report in the 1937 official records of the Egyptian government. As matters now stand, my method of prevention of blindness due to glaucoma is classified falsely as discredited. It has been placed on the AMA and the ophthalmologic gang's, quote, index expurgatorius, unquote. And rare indeed is the physician who would dare to sin by trying to read about the treatment or investigate it. The day still is saved for the operating merchants in ophthalmology, vendors of blindness by operation, and for their purses. Statistics to the rescue. To uphold the reputed value of glaucoma operations, statistical manipulations were necessary. In my volume, Glaucoma and Its Medical Treatment with Corton, and in my paper read at Rochester, I presented the first published results of operations on glaucoma victims by some of the leading surgeons in the country. The figures showed that 50% of the cases were blind after the first operation, 80% after the second, and all after the third. Removal of the eye after operation was necessary in over 6% of the cases. Vision was impaired and useful vision lost in the great majority of cases. My work showed that this wholesale blinding of victims of glaucoma by operation could be averted by medical treatment. The authenticity of the report was emphasized by the fact that the name of the surgeon who operated on each case was published in the report. The damage done by the compiling of the true data regarding the results of glaucoma operations was accentuated by their publication in the New York Times after I had presented them before the medical section of the AAAS in 1936. This was B.C., before the censorship of the press by the AMA, which was imposed directly thereafter to avert any repetition of damage to the surgical business. A study of the results of glaucoma operations was instituted as a quote-unquote survey project by Drs. Lewis Lairfield and Jacob Reber of the Wills Hospital, Philadelphia. It was published in the November 1937 issue of the Archives of Ophthalmology. This study showed results little differing from those published by me, though they were interpreted, as might be expected, in favor of operations. Such a conclusion was permitted by the fact that the survey of this eye condition interested itself in everything except how much vision was left to the patient after operation. All pertinent data with regard to vision were omitted in the publication. Believing this to be an oversight, I wrote to the authors requesting information with regard to the visual results of the operations and received no reply. The omission was not accidental. Discoveries in prevention of blindness. Continued research enabled me to discover methods of checking the advance of nearsightedness or of preventing its development. Shortly after that, I stumbled on a spectacularly successful method of treating a blinding disease of eye known as retinitis pigmentosa. This disease had been a complete and hopeless riddle. Easily recognized, the only information that the doctor could give the patient was that he would surely and inevitably be completely blinded after a limited time had passed. There had been no suspicion of its true cause and nature, or of any method of successfully treating the condition. I found in many cases that the injection into body muscles of keratine, the yellow coloring matter of carrots, which gives rise to vitamin A, and to visual purple in the body, would check the advance of this disease and would restore some of the lost vision. This notable and important discovery was barred from publication in the journals controlled by the AMA, including Science. It found publication only in the scientific magazine Nature, published in England. It has been confirmed recently by Professor Cherkez of Odessa. Professor Cherkez's report confirming my discovery was published in the United States in abstract form in both the journal and in the 1939 yearbook of Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat. The discovery was attributed in these abstracts to Cherkez, and no mention was made of his statement that he was merely confirming my report. The same fate was shared by my discoveries of the causes and remedies of other previously hopelessly blinding conditions, keratoconus and the Lawrence-Beadle moon syndrome. My discovery of the highly successful method of treatment of pneumonia, as I have already related, was also suppressed in this country. Other suppressed discoveries. I have related my own experiences with the suppression of medical discovery, not because they are unusual in present-day medicine, but because I am more intimately familiar with their details. Rarely such incidents manage to penetrate the press censorship and come to light, as in the case of the important discovery by Drs. Arthur Steinberg and William R. Brown of the Kensington Hospital, Philadelphia. The doctors discovered that minute amounts of oxalic acid play an important role in causing blood to clot, and that injection of the acid would save the victims of hemophilia and other diseases from death by bleeding. The discovery was made all the more momentous because it contradicted what has been taught regarding the effect of oxalic acid on blood clotting. In the test tube, oxalic acid prevents clotting, but the doctors had carefully verified their observations on more than 500 cases in a dozen Philadelphia hospitals. The life-saving character of their discovery made it so important that the doctors sent a report of it to the magazine Science. No doubt, on the advice of the omniscient AMA censors, this amply verified discovery was denied publication on the ground that it was quote-unquote unproved. That meant that, in their ignorance, the quote-unquote preservers of the faith of the AMA did not believe it. In denying publication to this discovery, the editors of Science had not the excuse and alibi that they have adopted to defend their refusal to publish some medical discoveries. They state that it is their policy not to publish clinical work, but only experimental work, which guinea pigs and other experimental animals have confirmed. Doctors Steinberg and Brown had done extensive animal experiments verifying their report. This makes it obvious that the true reason for the censorship exercised by the editors of science is purely political. Fortunately for the public, the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology still has escaped AMA control and censorship, and the doctors were able to publish their results on April 29, 1939, at its Toronto meeting. In their publication, they mentioned the censorship and suppression of their work by science and by the American Association for the quote-unquote advancement of science. Suppressed discoveries are mankind's loss. These experiences are characteristic of those of independent research workers. The situation is mighty discouraging to the true research worker who finds his work discredited, ignored, or stolen by such political rings or committees. At the best, these seekers after the truth expect little enough reward for their work. They spend their own funds for equipment, material, and help, and give many a day to the quest for a single nugget of truth. In return for their labors to lighten the lot of mankind, the most that they can expect, usually, is the bit of glory which attaches to publication or to reading a paper. Or, rarely, a cheap medal or prize is the reward. It is astonishing that a small group of individual workers continue to bear the torch of truth-seeking, in spite of the denial to them of even these trifling, meretricious rewards for their efforts and sacrifices. What is even more amazing is that it is generally these workers who lead the way of advance of medical science in the face of antagonistic quote-unquote authority. They are compelled to struggle to give their life and health-saving discoveries to mankind. A way must be found to encourage these valiant men that vested interests, politics, and commercialism will not be able to thwart. Otherwise, there will be forced on the pioneers of humanity a cynicism that will lead them to refuse mankind the gift of their discoveries and to command payment by making private, secret remedies of them. This was the practice in the dark Middle Ages, and there is evidence at hand that, again, it is in vogue among medical merchants. Research reforms. Everyone has a vital interest in the elimination of the research rackets, for upon honest and effective research rests the hope of prolongation of human life and of avoidance of disease. The first step in the destruction of the research rackets would be the elimination of research regimentation and of monopolies of research funds and facilities. This would imply, among other things, the elimination of fraudulent associations which collect funds for the ostensible purpose of aiding research and then utilize them for payment of salaries and administrative charges, for they exhaust public generosity that supports research. Likewise, foundations which serve primarily as commercial voting trusts should be converted to public agencies. Research and discoveries that serve public interests should be stimulated by a system of public prizes and emoluments that would pension the discoverer for the purpose of devoting himself to further researches. Such a plan might be made self-financing by a provision for patenting discoveries. Provision should be made for demonstration and evaluation, compulsory on demand of the discoverer, of medical discoveries in municipal hospitals after the methods first have been proved harmless in animals. Freedom of speech and publication essential. For the purpose of facilitating and stimulating the rapid dissemination of proved and valuable discoveries, accurate releases should be made for publication in the press. freedom of thought, speech, and publication in science and in medicine must be reestablished in the interest of public welfare. The words of Watson Davis, the director of Science Service, at the censorship dinner tendered by the AMA to the science writers in 1937 cannot be repeated too often or stressed too greatly. Quote, "Freedom of speech and freedom of press within the medical profession and its allied fields are just as important as the freedom of the public press. It is of public concern if dominant views within any scientific group tend to suppress minority or unconventional opinions." Unquote. Unfortunately, these noble sentiments were lip homage and do not guide the policies of the Science Service. The service is now completely censored by the AMA rackets. Chapter 9. Hospital and Clinic Rackets. Because hospital facilities are often essential for the present-day practice of medicine, quote-unquote Doc Simmons and his AMA crew set out to gain for themselves complete control of hospitals throughout the country. But the hospital business is rich and profitable. The AMA was forced to contest control with two powerfully entrenched groups, the American College of Surgeons and the Social Service Trust. Eventually, after much maneuvering and many battles, these three groups compromised and divided the hospital into, quote, spheres of influence, unquote. In some states, these spheres have been given legal ratification. The consequences of their activities to the public and to the rank and file of the medical profession is strikingly illustrated by a story published in the April 13, 1929 issue of the Milwaukee News Sentinel. This report of a survey on hospitals made among the rank and file of the local medical profession reads as follows. Medical men find hospital rates too high. Hospital prices in Milwaukee must come down if a crisis in the welfare of the medical profession is to be averted, many Milwaukee physicians stated. The hospitals have increased their price scale to such an extent that the patient of moderate means has nothing left for the doctor after he has paid the bill. One well-known downtown physician declared, "These hospitals pretend to be charitable institutions when, in fact, they are exacting top prices in a great majority of instances. I am afraid to take a patient to a hospital unless I know he has enough ready money to pay the bill," this doctor continued. "In some instances, the hospital authorities will reduce the price scale slightly if I make a special plea, and in very rare instances will take a patient free of charge. The usual reductions, however, leave the final bill still exorbitant. Either there is profit in hospital operations in Milwaukee, or there is gross mismanagement." Physicians spoke frankly of their grievances when assured anonymity, but shut up like clams when asked to discuss the situation publicly. "I can't afford to get in bad with the hospitals at this time," one physician with a large practice said. "The hospitals in this city are able to run things their own way." This physician produced a bill which had been rendered one of his patients for 2 days' hospital care. The bill was for $30, but had originally been made out for $37. "Here is an example," he said. "The patient underwent a simple operation when I pleaded with the authorities to cut the bill because of the patient's poverty. It was reduced $7. You can't tell me that the hospital didn't make money at the $30 rate. I could have hired a hotel room and a nurse and performed the operation in a hotel for that price." The item of cost of hospitalization, the quoted doctors considered primarily from the viewpoint of their own incomes, though it obviously affected in equal measure the purses of their patients. In many communities since then, the problem of the cost of hospitalization apparently is solved in part by the adoption of group hospitalization plans. But the public is confronted by many rackets that have been developed in connection with hospitals that affect what is more important than money, the patient's health and life. The patient is not in the average hospital long before he senses that there is something radically wrong about its organization that vitally affects him. He may sense it in the restriction in his choice of a physician to the members of the hospital staff, in the high fees that are exacted from him, in the attitude of indifference often shown to his comfort, convenience, or even vital needs. He and his friends may regard these as fancied or imagined, but they are very real. They are inherent in the character conferred upon hospital organization by the groups that have gained control over it. Social service in the hospital. The sphere of influence of the social service group is agitation for the construction of public hospitals, financing and construction of the quasi-public or quote-unquote voluntary hospital, and the management of the business of both. The organization, construction, and operation of voluntary hospitals and clinics is usually a very lucrative business for the moving spirits if sufficient voluntary contributions can be obtained. The first step taken by the social service group to get a new hospital or a new building for an old hospital is to raise the cry of, quote, overcrowded hospitals and clinics, unquote. It is a simple matter to bring about overcrowding even in communities with an excess of hospital facilities by the methods which will be described later. The control and censorship of the press which the social service forces have built up ensure ample publicity and protect them against any contradiction by informed persons. They also control the floodgates of charity and philanthropy and can divert such funds as they choose. The next step in the procedure generally is a joining of forces of the social service clique with a group of businessmen who are prospective directors and a small group of doctors who are prospective consultants. Usually, the members of the group contribute some capital or secure donations to the enterprise. This money may be invested in an old building or a plot of ground. Not infrequently, the owner of an otherwise unsaleable property is the moving spirit in the enterprise, and a true philanthropist, the prime sucker. With this nucleus, the entrepreneurs then bend their efforts to impress upon the community their charitable intent and public spirit. This is requisite under the social service laws of most states for the permit to operate a clinic or voluntary hospital, or to beg and solicit funds, bequests, and endowments from the public. The law of New York State, for instance, provides that no hospital supported by public subscription may be operated for acknowledged profit. With the accompaniment of a publicity campaign, solicitation of funds from the public is instituted by volunteers and by highly paid solicitors. Commissions of 50% and expenses to soliciting publicity firms are not unusual. The fraction of the funds donated by the public that is left over by the collectors is turned over to the directors. The disposition of the money in their hands depends upon the wishes of the individual board of directors. Seldom, almost never, is any public accounting ever made of the funds. The campaign of solicitation of funds may continue for years. There are many instances of collection of millions of dollars from the public for the erection and equipment of hospitals that could not conceivably cost a small fraction of the monies that have been collected for them. What happens to these millions contributed by the public, which never find their way into the building and operation of these hospitals? Even on superficial examination of the situation, it becomes apparent that these hospital funds are either inefficiently dissipated or grossly misappropriated. Many hospital groups readily confess to dissipation of funds. Such a confession by a prominent hospital executive was published in the Saturday Evening Post several years ago. Those who are most intimately acquainted with the financial operations of hospitals are inclined to attribute these protestations as pleas to the lesser offense in order to escape indictment on the greater. This ends part 20 of Your Life is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.